From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered, a podcast that brings you highlights from ATC on the weekends. I'm Rachel Martin, in for Guy Raz. This episode, are presidential candidates taking their cues from Hollywood?
We're seeing kind of a blurring of the line between politics and entertainment.
Also, the controversial Pentagon task force trying to help Afghanistan cash in on its mineral resources.
Afghanistan, with certainty, I can say, in 20 years, is going to be a mining country. That is going to happen.
And later, don't believe Facebook, why you can really only have 150 friends.
We developed this sort of 150 limit of relationships we could handle well at a time when most of those people lived geographically close to you.
We've also got lost toys, tastes, and trends of the 1970s and 80s, the gastroenterologist who won an international piano competition, and new music, you're hearing it now, from Moby. That's on this episode of The Best of Weekends on All Things Considered.
The United States of America is the most successful nation the world has ever known.
Summer movie season is here, and while what you're hearing may sound like a trailer for a summer blockbuster,
humans cannot reach their potential, cannot realize their dreams unless they're free.
It's actually an ad from presidential candidate Tim Pawlenty.
We have seen difficulties.
Sounds exciting, right? Here's another one.
I think we have to tell the American people the truth and lead with integrity. And ask the American people to rise to the occasion.
That's an ad from Mitt Romney, who announced his own presidential bid this past week. These ads use sweeping music, cinematic editing, and look more like Hollywood movie trailers than commercials about politicians. That's our cover story today, how Hollywood is reshaping campaign politics, why voters might buy in, and why one conservative movie producer is betting $1 million that they will. I'm Rachel Martin, in for Guy Raz. This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News.
They're very good ads.
Darrell West is author of Air Wars, Television Advertising in Election Campaigns.
They demonstrate kind of a new emerging trend in campaign advertising because we're seeing kind of a blurring of the line between politics and entertainment.
These ads, released online and some 2 minutes long, are coming mainly from Republicans right now. But West says their inspiration probably lies in Barack Obama's 2008 campaign. Back then, Obama aired a half-an-hour television special in primetime that was pretty cinematic in its own right.
The viewer is seeing wheat fields in the background. You see Americans engaging in daily activities. And then in the video itself, once you get into it,
each passing month,
Barack Obama uses very powerful visuals, images that people could relate to, and then using ordinary Americans to tell the story about the problems that they were having.
Mark Dowell and his wife Melinda have worked at the local plant for most of their adult lives. Juliana Sanchez is a widow with two children and a mortgage.
So that was 2008. Today's presidential candidates aren't just using narrative and music to tug on your heartstrings. They're trying to rip them apart.
It takes an extraordinary effort. It takes extraordinary commitment.
Some of these ads actually do take on the features of a mini-movie.
The Valley Forge wasn't easy.
Campaigns today really require a very strong storyline because there's just so much information out there in society. You need a strong narrative to break through all that information clutter.
And the rewards of breaking through that clutter are huge. In 2008, West says 80% of voters said TV was the most likely way they'd learn about a political candidate. 71% said political ads help me understand what a candidate stands for.
When you look at a campaign budget, about half of the money still goes for television ads because that's still, even in the internet era, where people get much of their information about the campaign.
And what about style? Is there any evidence that these more epic cinematic ads work better than traditional political ads? Is the audience saying, yeah, I'd see that movie?
People do believe that these epic ads are influential. Voters like to see those types of presentations. They often find those presentations memorable. And that style of communication can be very effective for politicians.
Darrell West, he's the author of Air Wars, Television Advertising in Election Campaigns. For a deeper look at the cinematic techniques at work in ads like Tim Pawlenty's, we went to NPR's film critic, Bob Mandello.
If you watch this ad, it is a whole bunch of little tiny bits. There's lots of quick edits between things like a Martin Luther King speech and jets flying over. I'm not sure what all that has to do with Mr. Pawlenty, but it places him there. And the other thing is that he doesn't speak to the camera in this. He's giving speeches, but you never see him just sort of looking at the camera the way that you do in most political ads. It's designed to place him in the context of Americana and make him look very forceful by making him sound forceful. It puts all that music behind him.
Let's talk about that music. I mean, first, before we talk, let's take a listen.
If prosperity were easy, everybody around the world would be prosperous. If freedom were easy, everybody around the world would be free. If security were easy, everybody around the world would be secure. They are not.
That's high drama, man. Okay, now let's hear the speech from the ad, but as Pawlenty originally delivered it at the National Press Club this year.
If prosperity were easy, everybody around the world would be prosperous. If freedom were easy, everybody around the world would be free. If security were easy, everybody around the world would be secure. They are not.
So a little different.
Yeah, no, he's actually delivering the speech pretty forcefully. But, you know, when you have that music behind you, I mean, I want brasses behind me when I'm talking.
Yeah, it makes you sound very important.
Exactly. There's also a history of using this to power speeches in movies. And I have a favorite example of that. If you go back to the Henry V that Laurence Olivier made, he made it at the height of World War II, and he was trying to inspire the British public. And he did that with the music of his own voice.
We few. We happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so base.
That's 1944. Now, Kenneth Branagh came along and wanted to do Henry V in 1989. That's a different era. That's after Vietnam. War doesn't sound as appealing to a contemporary audience, so he needed to punch it up a little. And listen what he did.
We few. We happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall think themselves accursed they were not here.
Wow.
It's soaring, isn't
it? Oh,
it
is soaring.
And you do, you get all goosebumps.
And there's an optimism, strangely enough, about this speech of war.
Yeah, that music is just soaring, and it really pumps it.
But really what this is about is telling stories, and that's what filmmakers are doing. That's what they do with this music. They're trying to lead us to an emotional place. I guess it would make sense that in politics, they're trying to do the same thing. They're creating leading men and women characters.
You know, in film, you want to use everything that's at your disposal. You use the sound and you use the visuals, and these days you use the 3D to try and make it as full an experience as possible. I assume that in politics, they are trying to do exactly the same thing.
NPR's Bob Mondello, thanks.
Thank you.
Another candidate, potential candidate that is, with a cinematic call to action, is Sarah Palin. Filmmaker Steve Bannon spent $1 million on a documentary film about Palin. It's called The Undefeated, and it will screen across the country this month. Bannon says he made the film without any editorial input from the Palin camp, and he reaches deep for theatrical inspiration.
I needed to get to the people in Alaska. They would be kind of the Greek chorus. And you would actually be in the middle of the whirlwind, which was Governor Palin's time in Alaska. I would bring in sound ups, you bring in news footage, you bring in interviews, you bring in speeches, you bring in all this great footage they had out there in Alaska television. As I started to get into the film and actually physically make it, I realized I didn't want a narrator and I needed a linking device. Since I had studied particularly the first half of Going Rogue.
Sarah Palin's book.
Yeah, we went to HarperCollins and got the audio rights. So you hear her voice in there and it kind of links the scenes together.
So some might see a precedent for this work, looking at Barack Obama's half-an-hour television special that aired during the 2008 presidential campaign. Do you see a connection there? How is your film different?
I think it's very different. Look, I think film is, you know, plenty put out a two-minute video to start his. I think people are putting out videos in understanding that media is much more sophisticated. I think that I hearken back really to Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. I think feature film, and I think particularly feature nonfiction or documentary, can have a major role in explaining ideas and describing people's lives and their struggles. If a screenwriter had pitched you some of this, you know, her struggles with big oil and her struggles with the Republican establishment, it would be something like out of a screenplay. So these things lend themselves to dramatic interpretation, and I think you're going to see a lot more of it in the future.
And you talk about using these characters from Alaska as a sort of Greek chorus, with Sarah Palin as the heroine. Is there a risk of building her up as this character, as this leading lady, to the point where she can't possibly live up to the characterization of her?
Well, no, there's a lot of, by the way, it's not all successes. There's failures throughout this film. That's why I think it's inspirational. I think I have not heard one person that's seen this that's been politically illiberal say that I had to fix in to kind of, you know, make this like she's some sort of superwoman. It's not that at all.
So is Sarah Palin running for president?
You know, I have no idea. The good news is the other night Greta Van Susteren asked her what she thought when she saw the film. Her quote was, it blew her away. But she mispronounced my name. So it's, I don't really have any involvement.
Would you like her to run for president? Did you make this movie to convince her to run for president?
I certainly didn't make this movie to convince her, but I do think it's very important for particularly the Republicans and the conservatives to have a campaign like 1976 where you had President Reagan as an outsider.
But, you know, we should point out that the Republicans did lose in 1976.
They lost in 1976, that's correct, but you would not have had the Reagan Revolution. That's a great point. You had to have that to have the Reagan Revolution. I mean, look, this title of The Undefeated, because some of the left-wing bloggers have already said, well, doesn't the guy know she lost lieutenant governor? Lost
there is that, yeah.
Well, but you have to see the film. It's about some of the values she stands for, of the American working class, of the American middle class, these things of self-reliance and self-determination. That's really The Undefeated. And I made a bet at the beginning of this that American people are not just a fair people, they're an open-minded people. And I think if they see this film, I believe they'll see Governor Palin. They may not agree with her politically, but they will see her in a very different light.
So you liken yourself more to Michael Moore as a filmmaker, but Michael Moore is a very political, polarizing figure, someone who doesn't shy away from the fact that he's got an agenda, a political agenda. Do you think of yourself as a conservative counterpoint to that?
I think Michael Moore, look, is a master of the craft. I'm learning the craft. I don't agree with Michael Moore's politics, but I love watching his films because I think he's a master of what he does. Look, I think it takes the subject. We've had some Shakespearean characters in our politics. Here, I think we're, you know, very blessed in the degree that we have someone like Governor Palin, who comes from America's last frontier, and you also have President Obama, who comes from a very different perspective, but is also a very fascinating story.
Steve Bannon joined us from Arlington, Virginia. Thanks very much, Steve.
Thanks, Rachel. Appreciate having me on.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates is in Afghanistan this weekend. During his visit, he said the U.S. commitment to that country is firm, but not forever. In fact, the Obama administration plans to start withdrawing some troops next month. It's been a tough balancing act for the U.S., building Afghanistan up so it can keep al-Qaeda out without committing endless money and manpower. Gates, in particular, has been trying to lower expectations about how much nation-building the U.S. can do. Here's what he said in early 2009.
Afghanistan is the fourth or fifth poorest country in the world. And if we set ourselves the objective of creating some sort of Central Asian Valhalla over there, we will lose.
Yet for the past year and a half, the Pentagon has had a task force assigned to build an Afghan economy, basically from scratch. Not Valhalla, but still a massive undertaking. The director of that task force is resigning at the end of this month. We'll talk with him in just a minute. But first, I sat down with author Nathan Hodge, whose book Armed Humanitarians talks about America's love-hate relationship with nation-building.
I'd argue that we're nation-builders in denial in Afghanistan.
Hodge says the U.S. counterinsurgency strategy rests on a big assumption.
The idea that if you get at the root causes of poverty and development, you can kind of solve the problems of violence and failing or failed states.
And that is the idea behind Paul Brinkley's Pentagon Task Force. It was actually created in 2006 to turn Iraq's economy around. 4 years later, General David Petraeus moved it to Afghanistan to do the same thing there. Brinkley is trying to help Afghanistan get at and use the $1 trillion worth of minerals under its soil. To make that happen, he brings CEOs over to Afghanistan, executives from J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, even Kate Spade, and tries to get them to invest. But several lawmakers on Capitol Hill say the task force blurs the line between military and civilian missions, that touring CEOs around Afghanistan isn't something the Pentagon should be doing. So earlier this year, Congress ordered the task force to move its operation from the Pentagon over to the civilian-run State Department. Nathan Hodge says that could make it harder for the task force to travel around the country and do its work.
Problem is, people from the State Department, AID, they're not trained to be in combat zones. And very often, you're talking about doing this kind of armed development work while being shot at.
Paul Brinkley says there are inherent risks involved in this work, but ultimately, it's about convincing Afghans that the minerals under their soil could mean big rewards for the country.
We're seeing that virtuous cycle take hold. Their awareness that they have something that will enable them to free themselves from dependence upon international donors. And their understanding that they can create an economy based on something that the world needs.
Does the way of doing business in Afghanistan have to change in order to take advantage of these minerals?
I don't think of it as having to change. I think it has to be created. There's never been in recent history, or going back even millennia, a core indigenous source of wealth that would enable Afghanistan to have its own revenue base, its own base of wealth.
I mean, there is opium production, but obviously
there is, right? But that's not list that that's highly illicit, and that's a good point. In Helmand Province, where a significant amount of opium production takes place, we have communicated that there is literally billions of dollars of mineral wealth in Helmand Province. Properly developed, that completely dwarfs the poppy economy, right? But in order to properly develop it, there are changes. Creation has to take place of business practices that they've never had to do before. So it's less about changing a business culture as it is about providing them access to the global economy.
Part of developing these business rules of the road, right, for dealing with these minerals is making sure that once you get these minerals out of the ground, that there's a modus operandi for handling them and that this doesn't somehow become a corrupt industry. I mean, immediately you think about the Congo and blood diamonds, right, and what that did to that economy and that culture. How do you approach this?
This is our greatest concern, and it is still a great concern. Our approach to this is to provide access to world-class expertise from the mining industry who have done this work in the places that Afghanistan wants to emulate. This is not new. This has been done before. There are paths that can be followed, but there's a long way to go between where we are today and where that future can be. And there are a lot of places along that path where things can go in a direction we wouldn't want them to. Afghanistan, with certainty, I can say, in 20 years is going to be a mining country. That is going to happen.
What makes you say so?
Because of the wealth that it possesses and the demand for the wealth. This will become a mining center. The question of what kind of mining center it will be, mm-hmm, is the one that we all need to be taking very, very seriously now. I don't think history will look kindly upon the international community if, you know, we've put 10 or however many years we put into Afghanistan and the billions of dollars and the blood of our young men and women to have it turn into a Congo-like situation. And I think we all feel that responsibility and are doing everything we can to help Afghanistan move in a direction that avoids that outcome.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people have raised questions about whether the work that you're doing, which, let's be frank, in Afghanistan, you're trying to build an economy,
right,
starting from scratch, as right, we said, that this kind of work that it isn't appropriate that this be done through the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. I mean, as you've alluded to, this isn't something our government has really done before,
right,
let alone our military. You have decided not to make that move along with,
right,
your task force. Why?
Well, there's a host of reasons for my personal decision on departing here at the end of June. I mean, it's been 5 years. The second part is the entire federal administrative system in the Defense Department is going through a transition now. Many of our champions and sponsors and supporters are in the process of a transition themselves, Secretary Gates, General Petraeus, people who we've worked with very closely. So in terms of timing, those factors are as significant as any other. That decision created a moment where one could step back and say, okay, where are we at? What are we doing? How are we postured? And the fact that there's now an acknowledgement that this does need to probably get embedded within our civilian infrastructure is a good acknowledgement. So.
Is there any part of you that is hesitant about leaving the Afghanistan project right now? Now that you've got this, you know, you've got kind of some momentum.
Right. We're at a point of inflection in terms of the overall American mission in Afghanistan. What we're working very closely with our colleagues, both in the military and at the State Department, on is how do we effect a transition that ensures that the initiation of this work, that momentum continues to build and that things don't fall back.
Paul Brinkley, he's the Deputy Undersecretary for Defense and the head of the Pentagon's Task Force for Business and Stability Operations. Paul, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
There's a famous story among sociologists. It's about Bill Gore, the guy who founded Gore-Tex.
When Bill Gore set the company up, he set it up in his backyard, literally as a little home company.
That's Robin Dunbar,
professor of evolutionary anthropology at the University of Oxford, England.
And he says after a while, Bill Gore's company got bigger and bigger. Then one day
he walked in and he simply didn't know who everybody was, and it was his kind of gut instinct that the bigger a company got, people working for the company were much less likely to sort of work hard and help each other out within the company and do all these kind of things that make a company go.
So Bill Gore did some counting, and he figured that after about 150 people, folks at Gore-Tex just couldn't keep track of each other. It was just too many faces. It destroyed the sense of community. So he decided,
thereafter, whenever they needed to expand the company, he would just build a new factory, sometimes right on the parking lot next door.
The factories were capped at 150 people, and Bill Gore found things worked better. People knew each other. They worked better together.
Everybody had the same label on their jacket. It said Gore-Tex Associate, and that was that. Everybody knew who was the manager, who was the accountant, who made the sandwiches for lunch.
Robin Dunbar has spent a lot of his career studying this idea that after 150 people, human beings have a much harder time keeping track of each other. 150, in fact, is known among sociologists as Dunbar's number. Because it turns out, when you start looking, that number pops up in all sorts of places.
Hutterites, for example, up there in the Dakotas.
Each Hutterite community.
Very traditional life.
About 150 people. Same with the Amish.
150.
Hunter-gatherer communities.
Bushmen from Southern Africa, American Plains Indians, North American Indians, 150.
Even in militaries around the world, a typical company.
They have exactly this kind of structure. 150.
The reasons may stem from our primate ancestors, Dunbar says. In smaller groups, primates could work together, evade predators. And today, 150 seems to be the number at which our brains just max out on memory. But what does all this mean if you're not Amish or the CEO of Gore-Tex? We spoke to David Dobbs about this. He's a writer and blogger for Wired magazine. And he says, when you think about the way most people live now,
it's different. We developed this sort of 150 limit of relationships we could handle well at a time when most of those people would be the people who lived geographically close to you.
That means if you're anything like David, you probably don't live in the town where you grew up. He lives in London.
Hello?
Hello, Dad. This is David. Hello. Can you hear me?
Great to hear your voice after such a long time.
Yeah, I know. I've been rather...
But David's dad still lives back home in Texas.
You got another chicken?
We have a chicken.
When did you get the chicken? You used to have Thelma and Louise. What's this one's name?
Betty Sue.
Betty Sue. That's a good Texas name.
These days, maybe your siblings did the same thing. Left home, went to college across the country, then moved to yet another place for work.
Cynthia?
How you doing, bro?
David's sister, Cynthia, lives in California.
Talked to Dad a little while ago. He did tell me about his chicken. who's his only company right now.
Oh, where's Kathy?
Then there are close friends who live outside your area code.
You've been fishing lately, is that right?
I've been getting in some talking about fishing.
Okay. Well,
that's David's best friend, Dick, in New Hampshire.
I miss you, buddy. I'll see you soon.
Bye.
And there are old friends it's hard to stay connected to.
Hi, Mary Lee.
Hey, Dave.
How are you? Where do we start? How have you been the last 10 years?
Professor Robin Dunbar says it's tough keeping up.
This is very unlike traditional small-scale societies, and I think it's much harder to keep those relationships working and good when they're that distributed. And of course, that's why Facebook and other social networking sites really kind of work for people.
But according to Robin Dunbar, only 150 of the 800 friends I count on Facebook are really my friends. And not only that, David Dobbs says.
It struck me that looking after these things is a very complicated business, particularly in the information economy, if you're an information worker.
In other words, how do you balance your 150 friends and family members in a global economy when more jobs now require social networking? Robin Dunbar says it actually depends on the size of the place where you work. If it's a smaller company.
Under, say, 500 people, there's a very strong tendency for your workers, our colleagues, as it were, also to be your friends.
Workers in a big corporation, on the other hand,
so the company size gets up into the thousands.
Those people tend to have more friends outside the place where they work. And one final thing about Robin Dunbar's research, he says while modern society does in fact make it hard to hang on to friends who aren't geographically close,
this incidentally doesn't have any effect on family relationships. Family relationships seem to be very stable no matter how far away you go.
Thanks very much for calling, David.
They love you when you come back.
You bet, Pop. Kiss Kathy for me and take care. I love you.
Hey, love you. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
David Dobbs. His blog at Wired Magazine is called Neuron Culture. We also spoke to Oxford professor Robin Dunbar from his home in England. Is this music burned into your brain?
Oh, it is enough to fill our lives with love.
Do you fall into a nostalgic trance after a fizzy mouthful of pop rocks? Are you old enough to remember carrying a metal lunchbox to school? Then you are the perfect age to appreciate a new book called Whatever Happened to Pudding Pops? The Lost Toys, Tastes, and Trends of the 1970s and 80s. Author Gail Faschenbauer Cooper has compiled an encyclopedia of things that make you smile and say, oh yeah, I remember that. And you know what? There is even an entry on encyclopedias. Gail Faschenbauer Cooper joins me now from member station KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to the show, Gail.
Thanks so much.
So there's so much to talk about in this book. I want to start off on a sweet note. Let's talk about candy. I mean, I was reading this book the other night and just howling at some of these entries. I mean, we all remember, some of us of a certain age, there were these super sugary candies. I mean, Nerds and Pop Rocks.
Exactly. Bottle Caps was another
one. Oh, yeah, Bottle Caps.
From the same Wonka candy company. Pop Rocks were huge on our playgrounds because they were the only candy that fought back when they were inside your mouth being eaten. And if you weren't ready for them, they were kind of, whoa, a shocker taste.
Pop Rocks. Introducing Pop Rocks Crackling Candy. They'll burst all over your mouth in cherry, grape, and orange.
Pop Rocks.
Earlier, I mentioned encyclopedias, and it's something you don't really think about until it's pointed out, but no one has encyclopedias anymore. I mean, when I was growing up...
Well, and why would we need them, right? We have 26 volumes of heavy books on your shelf that your parents had to pay a lot of money for, but they're outdated. As soon as they're printed, they're out of date. But we loved them. You know, both my co-author, Brian Belmont, and I would sit and read them like they were books. We were just fascinated by the bizarre things you would only read about in the encyclopedia.
So all this stuff is fun, but you have to admit, Gail, most of it wasn't really meant to last. It is disposable to some degree. So why was it so important for you to catalog it like this?
You know, a bunch of reasons, but one of them was that just how far we've come, looking back at where we came from, you know, just the speed of change gets lost sometimes when we're in the middle of it. And I think looking back is something we don't always do enough. Another reason I wrote it was because I'm the youngest of seven and all my brothers and sisters are baby boomers. Their pop culture was dominated my life. And so to look back on my own was kind of a fresh experience for me and a neat treat.
One of the things that you point out in your book is the way that in the 1970s and 80s, we were actually obsessed with the 1950s.
Happy yes. Days, MASH on TV, these TV shows.
Oh, yeah.
Shauna
Na
in concert.
The
Grease, the movie. Have you thought about why that was? It's almost like this nostalgia doubling back on itself.
I think every generation looks back. When a certain generation gets older, they want to rehash their past. And maybe there was something in the 50s that in the 70s we needed to kind of work through. If you look at, MASH, which was set in the 50s, it was very much a 70s show. Alan Alda was a very sensitive 70s guy, not mm-hmm. your hardcore 50s doctor. And so maybe we were trying to look at that Korean War and kind of accept it in a 70s way.
And finally, whatever happened to these things?
New Jell-O Pudding Pops! New Jell-O Pudding Pops!
Pudding Pops are one of those things that when they were here in the 80s, thanks to the Bill Cosby ads, everyone knew about them, and then they vanished for a while, and they very quietly came back in about 2000 or so, but Jell-O had licensed them to Popsicle, so they had a different shape, and people said the recipe wasn't the same. But the joy recipe. That you would see in a person who would be like, Pudding Pops are back? That was kind of like why we wanted to do the book, to tell them, so many things from your childhood may be back. They may have different names or different formats, but a lot of this can be found, and we're going to tell you where you can find it.
Gail Faschenbauer Cooper is the author of Whatever Happened to Pudding Pops, The Lost Toys, Tastes, and Trends of the 1970s and 80s. Gail, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Don't you forget about me.
Christopher Shee, what were you doing in the 1970s and 1980s? I mean, I imagine you were playing a lot of piano.
Well, I started playing piano when I was five. I was born in 1972. So, yeah, 70s and 80s was a lot of violin and piano practice.
And that practice paid off. Christopher Shee never became a professional concert pianist, though. He got his medical degree and became a gastroenterologist, but he kept entering competitions. And last Sunday, he won the prestigious Van Cliburn International Piano Competition for Outstanding Amateurs. This is an excerpt from Christopher Shee's award-winning performance of Variations on a Theme of Handel by Johannes Brahms. And what did Christopher Shee do after he won the grand prize? Well, he went to Disney World, of course.
It kind of turned out that way. Obviously, we planned the trip well before I knew the results of the competition. It turned out to be kind of a nice Super Bowl moment.
You got to say when the reporters came up to you, where are you going?
Yeah, well, that's on Facebook I posted. Well, thank you for all of the nice comments. And now I'm going to Disney World.
When you were a kid, obviously, you spent an awful lot of time practicing the piano. Did you think at that point that you could become a professional?
Well, it obviously crossed my mind, but I have to say I never seriously considered a professional career in music because from a very young age, I was very practical and I knew how difficult it was, no matter how good you are. And the truth is, I've always liked science and medicine, so it was never a difficult choice to decide to become a doctor.
Are there things you do as a ritual before you perform in something like this?
I don't have anything particularly weird that I do. A lot of us eat bananas before we play. I don't know if you've heard that. Athletes do that too.
Well, potassium.
Yeah, the potassium, and supposedly it calms the nerves. And I don't mind sharing this. I suffer from terrible stage fright. And so I take 40 milligrams of propranolol about an hour before I perform.
And that just calms you down?
It helps, yeah.
Can I ask you a little bit about that? When it comes to you, when you start to be seized by this stage fright, how does it manifest? What happens?
Well, in its best possible form, it kind of sharpens your senses and keeps your concentration going. In the worst possible form, it's debilitating, and it kind of freezes up both your mind and your fingers. And I have experienced that before in performance, which is why I'm deathly afraid of going in without some kind of help.
After you finished your final round performance in this competition with that Brahms piece, can you walk me through what was going through your mind right when you finished?
That last chord, I thought, oh, thank goodness there were no major disasters.
Thank goodness it's over.
Thank goodness it's over.
And when they called your name, said, "You, Christopher Shee, you have won first place," were you surprised then?
Yeah. I was very thankful that the jury was appreciative of my performance. But, you know, this may sound cliche, but especially in an amateur competition, the winning isn't really the goal, but rather to perform these works at a high level and to enjoy the social experience with all these other wonderful people.
Christopher Shee, thank you so much again, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And before I let you go, since you came all this way, could I persuade you to play something for us?
Oh, I suppose so.
What are you going to play?
I'm going to do the first piece that I played in the preliminary round of the competition. It's a transcription of Bach's Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring by the British pianist Myra Hess.
Christopher Shee is a gastroenterologist from Ellicott City, Maryland, and last weekend he won the Van Cliburn Piano Competition for Outstanding Amateurs. In the 1990s, Moby took techno music out of the dance clubs and onto the pop charts. For his new album, Destroyed, he's moving even further from the crowded dance floor into isolation. An insomniac for most of his life, Moby wrote the album while he was on tour, alone, late at night, in hotel rooms across the world. The music evokes feelings of sadness, solitude, and loneliness. Alongside the record, Moby is also releasing a collection of photographs, images of long hallways, empty dressing rooms, views from the windows of buses and airplanes. It's the view of a musician's life that fans don't normally see.
I've been a photographer for as long as I've been a musician, which is 35 years. And for some reason, I've always been really hesitant to show people my pictures. And I guess what I wanted to do with the photography in this book is show a very different side of touring and life on the road. I mean, because there's no shortage of books showing the very glamorous, very sexy side of rock and roll touring, you know, of backstage parties and private planes and whatnot. Whereas for me, touring tends to be a very strange and disconcerting and very isolating experience. And that's what I was at least trying to accomplish with the book.
What is isolating about it for you?
Well, being on tour, you have this strange juxtaposition between standing on stage in front of 50,000 people and then being completely isolated in a dressing room that's anonymous and soulless and alien. After a while, it does very strange things to your psyche.
You capture some of the feeling of this loneliness of touring, particularly in the broken places. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where that came from.
A lot of the music on the album does have a similar feel to this song in that it was written in hotel rooms at 4 o'clock in the morning, where I've been sitting at a desk, looking out a window at a completely empty city and feeling like I'm the only person alive. I'm certainly the only person awake. And just that sense of solipsism and isolation that on one hand it is strange and disconcerting, but there's also a sense of comfort to it.
Insomnia. You say this is something that you've suffered from for a while. When did it start for you? When did you start having problems sleeping?
Well, the first time I remember having insomnia, I think I was 5 years old. So I've basically had it on and off for about 40 years.
Wow.
And in many ways, I have the single worst job for an insomniac. You know, like if I were a farmer and I got to sleep in my bed every night and go to sleep at the same time and wake up at the same time, I'd probably do okay. But I'd travel around and sleep in different hotel rooms and go between different time zones. And I have to make it very clear, I'm not complaining because I choose to live this way.
Yeah.
But it is a really terrible job for an insomniac.
What happens to you in those moments when you can't sleep?
Well, what I've tried to do recently is get up and do something. You know, either get up and go for a walk or work on music or take pictures or do something as banal and quotidian as playing Scrabble on Facebook. But just something so I'm not lying in bed just cursing the fact that I have insomnia.
A lot of these photos evoke that. They look as if they were taken late at night when the rest of the world is sleeping. Is there something different revealed in that time of day?
I think so, because it's the time of day where the world that we've created is for the most part being ignored. And I think that's why I'm so fascinated by empty airports and empty hallways, almost on a forensic level. Like, what does it say about us as a species? These places that we've created for ourselves, but when they're completely empty and just sitting there and waiting for us.
So how do you fix this for yourself? Do I hear you saying that this isolation is difficult, but there are parts of it that are beautiful to you? Where is your respite? Where do you escape that isolation?
Dogs are nice.
Do you have a dog?
Unfortunately, no, I travel too much. But I've sort of made a deal with myself that at the end of this tour, I just moved to Los Angeles, and I actually have a yard. So the deal I've made with myself is when the tour is over, I'm going to go back to L.A. and try and have a girlfriend and maybe have a couple of dogs.
We're talking to the musician Moby. His new album, Destroyed, was released last month. So you've got this new album out, and you're out there promoting it. And at the same time, though, it seems like all anyone wants to talk about are comments you've made recently in interviews, made some headlines. Comments about pop music today, songs by Kesha, Rihanna, Britney Spears. You were quoted in an interview as saying their songs are fun, but too manufactured, that they're more like advertising for ringtones, which is pretty tough words. Considering some of your music, and I'm thinking some of the more popular songs on Play, for example, could perhaps be described in the same way by some.
Well, I guess there's a difference. When I was describing a lot of contemporary pop music, when I say that it's constructed to be sold as ringtones, I almost don't mean that as a criticism. Mm. I mean that anthropologically it's really fascinating. It's just, by my criteria, it's not music. You know, when I think of Leonard Cohen or Neil Young or Joe Strummer from The Clash sitting down to write music, you know, they're trying to express themselves passionately through playing guitar and singing. And although in the course of my life I have made some commercial compromises to get my music heard, which mm-hmm. meant licensing music to advertisements or movies or TV shows, the music itself was written as an expression of myself. So I was willing to sort of like make a Faustian bargain in order to get the music heard, but I was never willing to compromise the music itself. And there was also a part of me that always thought it was probably a lot cooler to take money from big corporations and give money to big corporations. If you give money to a corporation, you know, if you buy a car, you're supporting a car company. And if you take money from the car company, it's almost like there's a Robin Hood thing of taking money from the car company and giving it to environmental organizations.
I want to get back into the new album. One of the songs is called The Right Thing, and it seems to be about this inner struggle between these polar extremes, between the good and the evil. Let's listen to a little bit. One day I know, gonna leave it all alone, gonna leave it, leave this all for heaven. We've talked in the past about your own kind of spiritual journey. How has that changed as you have grown older?
Well, when I was a lot younger, I was a militant atheist. And then almost overnight, I went from being a militant atheist to being a militant Christian. And then I became interested in Taoism because I had a crush on a girl who was a Taoist.
Sure.
And then I had some friends who were interested in Buddhism and Hinduism. So over the years, I've just been a spiritual dilettante. And at this point, I have a deep aversion at this point to what I would refer to as like competitive spirituality. You know, when someone believes that their Christianity is better than someone else's Christianity, or their Hinduism is better than someone else's Islam, like, that to me reeks more of like professional sports teams than anything pertaining to the pursuit of God.
You have released this book of photographs. You have moved to L.A. into a house, into a neighborhood that feels more like home to you. Are you starting a new chapter for yourself?
I have no idea, because if I answer yes, that's just an invitation to step out on the street and get hit by a bus. You know, so if I say to you that, yes, this is a new chapter and I'm so optimistic and everything's going to work out, that just means a piano is going to fall on my head. So, you know, the best case scenario, things work out and we all still die. So it seems like our effort should go towards trying to make, not necessarily understand the universe in which we live, just try and make peace with our role in it.
That's the musician Moby. His new album and photography book, both called Destroyed, were released last month. Moby, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I feel like we've had a therapy session. I'll send you $250.
Checks in the mail. I've heard
yeah,
it before.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Petra Mayer and produced by Phil Harrell, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Megan Kane, Brent Bachman, and Sarah Gonzalez. Daniel Shukin is our technical director. Rick Holter is our senior editor. And our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Rachel Martin.